Welcome to the Grin Gets Real podcast, the show for people who want to maximize their marketing potential. My name is Katya, and I am your host on this exciting journey as we talk to our experts who join us. From influencer marketing to e-commerce strategy and everything in between, each episode will feature industry experts that share their insights and provide actionable tips to help you achieve your marketing goals. So put your AirPods in, turn up that volume, and get ready for our guest, Kurt Phil. Kurt, thank you so much for coming on to the Grin Gets Real podcast. I'm really excited to have you on here to just kind of dive into all things, you know, conversion rate optimization or CRO. I won't give away the secret sauce because I am going to ask you the basics, but welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me on. I've been looking forward to chatting about this one with you for a while.
Absolutely. Well, I would love to just have you share a little bit about your expertise, how you came to be, known as the CRO guy, or just mm-hmm. into this industry and the why behind that.
Yeah, sure. I think a few years ago, I'd spent most of my adult career, I guess, if you can call it that, in mm-hmm. SEO. So that was where I'd spent most of my time and focus, and most of my friends and my network were built around that. And I started to work for a company, I was partnered with a guy who was probably the number one guy in SEO where I was situated. And then from there, I was positioned as the conversion and monetization head. So from that, we did a lot of podcasts, some seminars and conferences together. And it was right when CRO or conversion rate optimization was starting to boom. And then, yeah, it sort of just naturally progressed from there. Did some pretty high profile conversion optimization case studies and pumped them around, and a lot of guest posts on notable blogs. And then sort of here we are today, 4.5, 5 years later, with a team of 20, 25, something like that. So
you're growing experts in the industry, which I can really appreciate. I always really like to start off with the basics. You know, our audience is marketers, but if mm-hmm. you can define or just share what CRO is, I mean, obviously it stands for conversion rate optimization, but mm-hmm. what is it?
So I think that a good way to explain it is just what is the goal of your website? You know, mm-hmm. there's many different types of monetization methods. You've got e-commerce websites, you've got local businesses that you're trying to get people to call or leave an email, you've got affiliate websites, which is top 10 best computer screens, you're trying to push people to Amazon. In order to optimize for conversion, you have to identify what the conversions are first, which let's just say it's an e-commerce website. So it would be generating more sales. Yeah. Now, most of the websites we see haven't built enough credibility or trust with the users. So that's where we spend most of our time optimizing the website. So displaying reviews in key places, having trust indicators like safe and secure icons, refund policies very clear near where they're going to be adding to cart, all these guarantees, these type of things to help build credibility and trust. Because think about how different it is today versus 10 years ago with buying online. Yeah. Most of the time you do it without even thinking about it. You get home and there's four boxes at your door and you don't even remember what you've bought. But then you open it and you're like, oh, yes, that was, I bought that on Tuesday night when I was browsing something. You don't know why you bought it. And that's what we do. We want to enable it. So when people want something, you push them through. They got to your website. That's great. That's the first part done. Now you have to keep them in that flow of purchasing all the way through to the end. Because if you're on the cart and it doesn't seem very secure and it seems a bit like a dodgy website, you don't have SSL certificate done and there's no lock icon at the top, or there's a bunch of other ones, or the website just doesn't render properly on mobile or desktop, you can lose them. So that's what we help our customers to do, is improve their website so it makes it not only trustworthy and credible but seamless to buy. How many times have you tried to purchase something and then you get to the add to cart and they want you to create an account and you're just ugh, and then you back out? Whereas why wouldn't you just not even ask them and just create an account anyway when you sign up and create a password for them, instead of asking them to create a password and username, just use your email to create an account and then tie their order to that account. And these are some things that new platforms like Shopify do automatically, but some of the old website themes on WordPress and things, people are still running old themes that don't have these, but they're doing 7-8 figures a year. You know, they've grown really big. So we help them to eliminate these frictions on their website.
Yeah, I think with e-commerce has obviously been a part of our lives for an extended amount of time, most recently, and especially with the pandemic as well, too. One of the things that continues to come up is that frictionless shopping, what it is that you're talking about, like make it easy for me to be able to view it and then purchase it. You're absolutely right. I mean, I think as soon as I hit too many friction points, like if I really want something, I know that I could probably go through two, but they have to be an easy two friction points. But if you navigate me all the way out to something else, don't make it easy for me to like click to my PayPal so that I don't have to get my wallet. Man, if I have to get off of the sofa, forget about it. I'm not purchasing anything.
Something great that Shopify did recently was if you've created an account with anyone else that's on Shopify, it'll automatically store your card details and address. You probably didn't even notice it because Amazon's been doing it forever. But they copied Amazon, and this is a powerful thing about Shopify is they can control the whole checkout process on any site on their whole, I don't know how many tens of millions of websites they have. So they have the data, and they would have tested that. They would have A/B tested it, and it would have had astronomical increases. So I notice when I'm buying things and I log in with the same username and password, all right, my credit card's saying, cool, done, bye. It's just Amazon's the leaders in it, right? So anything they're doing, try and copy as much as you can because three or four clicks from product page through to checkout without having to enter any extra details is huge for making sales. So
I think you just gave away the secret sauce. Just copy Amazon and then that's it.
To a point, 100%. But it's easier said than done, right? Like you can copy them, but do you know what you're wanting to copy? And to be honest, their website looks a bit dated, right? Yeah. Like if you look at it, you're like, man, this needs a refresh. But it works and it's like that's their branding now. So it would be hard to update it. And I've seen them run tests before. They've got like an inbuilt testing function in their website. Sometimes you get a different variation of a product page because they are always testing micro adjustments because like one little tweak of 0.005% increase in conversions would equal, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars over time. So they're always doing incremental changes on the website. It's pretty interesting stuff, but
well, is that really the basis of CRO then is the testing out and, you know, a list of like 10 things that you should test out to see, you know, whether or not that does optimize to increase sales is that the basics of it?
There's like baseline CRO, which is things that you need to have on your website always that, you know, having reviews, having trust badges and things like this. And then there's split testing and A/B testing, which you can only really do once you've hit a large amount of traffic and sales. So, and it varies a lot depending on the type of website you have, but usually over 1,000 visitors a day, you want to start looking at A/B testing. Again, it depends on the type of site, but as a ballpark figure, because essentially with A/B testing, you're showing one variation of a page to one set of visitors and then another set to another, and you need to have enough data where the sample data is big enough where it holds true because, you know, statistically you could have 10 sales all on one page or all on one variation and zero on the next. And that could have just been completely random and that happened. Like you could spin heads and tails 10 times and get tails just by chance. You could, it's possible. Yeah. But over say 10,000 spinning of the coin, it would even out 50-50 distribution. And that's a great way to think about it is, over time, it eventually becomes statistically significant.
Well, so for an e-commerce site, it has lots of product pages. How do you even know where to test or what to test if you have a website like that that has a ton of just kind of product pages? Wait, one of the things that you said was it's, you know, at least 1,000, you know, hits to your website, but is that across all pages, across all of your website? Like, how do you know what page to test?
That's why I used it as a ballpark because that's exactly right. But essentially, if you have, let's just say 1,000 products on your website, but if they're all using the exact same product page, you can combine data and run tests on all the pages at the same time and combine the data if it's the same element you're testing. Most of the sales from a website comes from 20% of the pages, right? So that's where 80% of the revenue is generated. And sometimes it's 95% of the sales is made from 5% of the pages. But you got to find those high converting pages and high sales pages and focus on those to start. For instance, you might have some t-shirt designs that have XL owl, small, and so on. And then they have also have yellow, orange, blue to choose from. So, and then, but you also sell socks in one type. You can't run tests on both those because they're different types of pages. But a way you could do that is find the highest traffic of those variations to test. Again, it gets very confusing when you get into the nitty gritty, but essentially you need a lot of visitors to the page to run the test so that you can get that statistical significance, you know, so you're not just getting the anomalies when you're running the test.
Well, and when you talk about statistics, and we were talking about this just before, you know, we started the podcast, was the difference between the qualitative and the quantitative. And you had a really interesting take in regards to when you even look at, or if you even look at qualitative metrics, if there are any qualitative metrics, how do you use that? Should you just stick to quantitative metrics to help you make better decisions to optimize your website? At what point does qualitative come in?
Yeah, so that's qualitative you can use when, let's just say you've done a redesign and it's hard to quantify how much that has impacted conversions because a lot of the time it doesn't really. It's like a branding improvement, right? Making the site look more modern. You can't statistically go and run the test side by side just with a design change because it won't really show in the split testing. User testing, essentially, you pay per, you can buy a pack of like 10 or 100 visitors to come to your website. These people are paid to do it and they give you feedback on your website. So you might give them a goal. You might be like, buy one yellow t-shirt and two pairs of socks and tell me about your journey, any friction points that you go through and things like this. And it's great if you've just built a website and you've got it up and running. And a lot of times because you've designed it, you can't see the issues. You're just blind to them. For instance, you see it all the time where you add something to cart and a little number one comes up next to the cart icon, but it doesn't tell you anything and you don't even realize that's happened and you don't know to click next. That would be an example. That's what I had back when I had one of my websites tested years ago. They were like, I don't know what to do next. There's no next button or checkout button. You actually have to click the cart, then check out. And it was confusing to the users. So that was a great insight that you necessarily wouldn't be able to split test because you don't know it exists, kind of thing. Also, another one is, for instance, we do it with our customers. Once they've finished a campaign with us, we ask them, or sorry, when they finish a campaign or when they sign up, you know, why, why, what would have been some things that would have made them not sign up? Were there any friction points they had during their journey to sign up with us? Were there any things that they maybe found that made them think twice about what I said on the sales call or whatever? That's also another way to do qualitative that you couldn't necessarily get from split testing, but could improve their your overall conversions by fixing those things.
Do you think that you need a good combination of both qualitative and quantitative, or would you split that into like an 80-20? I love the 80-20 rule, by the way, because I think that that is something, that principle is something that can be applied to pretty much anything right?
Exactly.
When it comes down to it. But like, you know, we were talking about the significance of that quantitative. That's really going to help you identify whether it's working or it's not. So like, what is that split of qualitative, quantitative? If I'm just getting started on really optimizing my website.
Think about it like with qualitative, it's more subjective. Whereas quantitative is like pure data. With this variation of my website, I created 100 sales. With this variation, I created 120 and I created this much revenue. It's very easy to be able to use data to make those, whereas qualitative is more subjective. You're asking about their opinion on something, I guess. So I don't
how
like
they
to
feel
use,
about it.
Yeah, exactly. It's more of a, an emotional questionnaire type of thing a lot of the time. I recommend doing it if you've just launched a website or started or released a new product, or you want to get some eyes on your business that aren't biased, because it can be very difficult inside, especially if you work in an office or you work with the same people every day, to give feedback because of biases that are built in, because like you might have just wrapped up this project and you don't want to think about it anymore. So you're not going to say to your boss, I think it's a piece of crap. And then you also might not be impressed that you've done that because they've put, you know, but if you use outside eyes on it, it can give you some very non-biased opinions on your product or website. I'm going to run this user brain through our website at the moment because we've had a ton of iterations on A/B testing, but we haven't had a set of eyes on it from non-conversion people, right? Because people are typing in conversion rate optimization services or whatever, and we're coming up in Google, and they're already at that like awareness stage that they want to find services. Whereas these people, educated technological wise, but they're not necessarily in that mindset. So they might be like, I don't even know what this is. And then that'll allow us to communicate it better, I guess. So.
Yeah, I definitely think that the qualitative is measures more of like the sentiment. How does someone feel about your brand? How does someone feel about your product? You know, that emotion that they walk away with. But the quantitative, I find so interesting because, you know, you have to fight feeling with fact. And that's where the metrics come in. Mm-hmm. So when we're looking at, you know, the pages that we're testing and we're looking at those metrics that are coming back, how long do you typically test something to have enough of that data to make an informed decision? Or is there even a time period?
So there's a bunch of different things that, like, we have a calculator that works this out, because it's how many visitors come to the page, but then also how much of an increase is the variation against the original. For instance, if you have a 50% increase in conversions against the original, you're going to need much less data to confirm that that's correct. Whereas if it's like a 0.05% increase, you may never get a result, because one or two conversions here and there either way will like throw that out. So generally we see split testing results at the month to 6 week time frame. But we only work with websites with a large amount of traffic. That's like they've already been filtered out, the smaller ones. So it's hard to know when you're at the stage when you should be doing split testing. But generally, it's at anything above 1,000 visitors a day is recommended. But we only work with much bigger, because they're paying us a monthly retainer. We need to get them results every month. So if it was someone who's getting 500 views a month, it may take 6 months to get one test result, and that's just not really viable.
Do people come to you guys with like a set expectation of like, I want to generate, you know, 10% more sales on my website, and that's the campaign that I want to run? Is that the way the process works?
Not necessarily, because it's hard. You can't, like, we've run thousands of split tests in the past, but we could run the exact same test on one website and get not a completely different result, but a different result, because a different set of visitors, different product and so on. But we do get that. And sometimes with some people, we get creative with the campaigns, and we do have results-based deliverables like that. Like, for every 10% increase in conversions, we get compensated this much and so on, because some people purely want results. We can do that, definitely. But like, we had one guy come to us a while ago that said, I want 300 to 400% increase in conversions. And that was his expectation when he was trying to find a conversion company to work with. I can dare say that no one would work with him if that's his expectation that he's trying to set, kind of thing, right? Yeah. So much. He probably saw some blog post or something that said you could do that. Yeah, something like that, and then wanted to do that. But generally, every test, you can get between 5 to 10% pretty consistently per test, depending on the type of site. But again, that number's, it depends. It depends. But we've got a lot of data on what works and what doesn't. So when we're testing a site, we know something's worked 50 times, so we'll go and test it more to show the customer what exactly the effect it had on the website. It further validates what we're doing, type of thing. Yeah. And it also catches the losers, because not every time you'll get a winner, and you can catch the losing tests, which would have had a negative effect on their revenue. So,
but at least it plays a role in informing you, you know, whether it worked or not, which I think is really key when it comes down to it. Now, you know, you have mentioned that there are some best practices. You know, I went on your site and you have this really great blog that just kind of breaks down some CRO best practices. Mm-hmm. But if you had to pick, like, you know, top three best practices, like if you're getting started and you want to test something out on your website, where do I get started? Is it with the trust signals at the top? Is it, you know, changing the wording, the color of a CTA button? Are these things that are typically on your best practice list to just kind of figure out?
It depends on the type of website, but as a whole, trust and credibility are the main things. So, like, a lot of people will have all the reviews on a reviews page.
Yeah.
But no one's going to go and like visit a reviews page. What you want to do is you want to have the reviews near the top, in the top section, not on one of these carousels that shows one at a time. Like, those are really annoying. You want to have like five or six all showing at the same time with five star, what the review is, even if it's on Trustpilot or one of the credible platforms, like have it so it clicks over to that and they can see it's real, you know, so that it's further credible. Another one that worked really well for us at the start was to build credibility in an industry where no one knew who we were. We just went out and did free CRO on a lot of authorities' websites and in exchange for a blog post or a case study on their website, not on our website, but on their website, which further builds that credibility. And then that was a good way to do it too, which a lot of people do. So if you have a new product, go out and give the product away in exchange for a review, which is a bit of a gray area. I know on Amazon, they don't like people to do that. Yeah. But I mean, on scale, of course, and you need it to be natural. Like you need it to be like actually get the people to test it. If you can get a video review, even stronger again. So what you want to do is you want to make it so anytime someone looks for anything about you, you have positive feedback, sometimes critical feedback, but yeah, you don't really want like the one star, this is the worst company ever type of reviews because that's going to harm obviously a lot. But if you, like you want some stuff on YouTube, you want some two or three review platforms with good reviews on. I like to use Trustpilot because they have a good anti-spam filtering system. So they are expensive, but we've had a few of our competitors, I'm guessing, that just left one star review and just said, this is the worst company ever. Don't work with them. Beware, whatever. And then we triggered it, flagged it as a, reported it as fake. And then they had to show proof they work with us, whether it's emails, receipt, anything like that. And they couldn't, so I got taken down. Whereas I know people are struggling with Google reviews a lot of the time to have that done because it's Google. They don't really care so much as Trustpilot, which it's their main product. So, reviews and trust and credibility are probably the biggest for any website when you're starting out, especially.
Well, ironically, what you were describing is influencer marketing where you're, you know, gifting a product or a service, right, in order to get content back. And one of those pieces of content is always a review, right? Like you want their honest, authentic opinion about your service or your product. But kind of along those lines, right, you know, there are people who write a review and that's obviously that's something written. I don't know if you've tested this out at all in any sort of e-commerce stores, but I am now starting to see a lot of like the Instagram feed at the bottom of like some product pages. I see this all the time, especially with a swimsuit site, right? Like it's great to see it on the model, but it's also really great to see it on real people, you know, in real life. And that really impacts me when I see it. I'm like, okay, well, let me see what it looks like, you know, on a person that's not Photoshopped and all of that good stuff. Is a trust signal something like that too? Or 100%. Would you consider that?
Yeah. I remember there was a thing going around a while ago. I haven't seen it come up on Instagram ads so much anymore, but it was, they had Conor McGregor with the UV teeth whitening. Do you remember seeing that coming up everywhere? And that blew them up because of Conor McGregor, did it? Have you seen his sparkly white teeth? Even though he's got, even though he's no doubtably got veneers in because he's been punched in the face that much. But still, it was a huge way to build credibility and trust. And influencer marketing is not something I've spent a lot of time with, but it's a pretty easy one to work out. Get people that have influence to push your stuff. It happens with like look at the Love Island show in the UK. It's like the most popular show ever. And then they all go on there and they come off with an extra 200, 300,000 followers and they just flog crap. Like they just, one week they're selling turmeric gel and the next week they're selling like eye whitening cream. I don't know. It's like they all follow the same protocol, you know, because then people, the companies start looking for these influencers with audiences above 100K and then they give them free products. They do one photo with it. It's an interesting business model. It's not exactly sustainable on the influencer side, I don't think, for a vast majority of them. I'm sure 99.9% of them burn out pretty quick, but for the ones who do well, you know, good on them. But that's definitely a, especially in this day and age, it's definitely a more modern way to, especially product, like you said, swimsuits, supplements, protein powders, you see it all the time. Obviously, the guy on steroids hasn't actually used that protein powder, but it still looks good when he's all shredded holding like the new protein powder you've never heard of. But it works, you know, especially with the younger generation.
you know, you mentioned something about it being sustainable or not being sustainable from an influencer's perspective. And, you know, I think that you hit the nail on the head. It's not sustainable if you don't actually, you know, represent something that you actually use, right? That's mm-hmm. the difference. It has to be authentic in order for it to make an impact, because it leans into that trust that you're talking mm-hmm. about, right? Like, that's why for me, when I'm looking at Instagram pictures of like something that I want to purchase, right? Or reading a review, I want like that honest feedback. And truthfully, I look at the 5 stars, but I also look at the 1 star. Like, are they just kind of, you know, bitching about a brand, or mm-hmm. is this like a genuine negative, like,
or was review? It like the post they're giving a 1 star review because of the postman that delivered it? Like, delivered it wrong, right? Yeah, for sure. And that happens a lot.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Like, was that important to me? Was it not?
And this is all trust and credibility from a conversion perspective in different forms, right? But the way that I was explaining it before is like, how do you, like, what's the 80-20, you know? And it's credibility and trust. Review, like, what is your service and the thing you're offering? Below that, having some reviews or testimonials from people that have used that offering and speaking about it, then a bit about it, then maybe some case studies. It depends on, obviously I'm talking more from a service perspective. So some case studies about people who have used it, type of results you've got, a bit more about your service, more testimonials, more tests, like as many as you can, you know. If you can get video, it's been huge. I know a couple of guys that have done really well with video. It's just harder to get, and you have to have a lot of scale to get. Like, I think out of 750 clients we've had right now, I think we've had 2 video reviews. We've tried to get a lot of people, but with our demographic, more of an introverted tech crowd, it's like they just don't want to. They'll be happy to give a review on Trustpilot, but video is a little bit harder. But,
Now, you engage with a lot of different brands across a lot of different industries. What would you say are kind of common pitfalls that you see that come through your door all the time? Mm-hmm. Like, anytime someone's signing up for your service, what are some common pitfalls that people run into?
Not clearly communicating what exactly they're selling. If you remember in 2010 to 2015, it was very trendy to have like a slider at the top of your website that every like 20 seconds it would slide and show an image or whatever. But it like, you couldn't actually, no one actually could communicate what they were selling or what their cause is or what it exactly is. Now, when someone comes to your website, you have a fraction of a second to communicate what it is you're selling, what it is you're about, trust, credibility, and so on. So that's the main thing. Even some big brands, they don't clearly outline it at the top. They've just got like maybe an image of their product and it's like refreshingly refreshing. And you're like, what is, I don't even know what that means. And it's great, but you need to clearly outline what it is and then go into more detail below it. But in that top section, it needs to really communicate it so you can hook them. And then once you've got the hook, then they'll read on. But that's probably the most common pitfall. But then, and I'm going to sound like a broken record, but no one, almost no one shows enough trust and credibility on their website, even though they have it. You'll see, we'll see clients come through, they have like 2,000 5-star reviews on Amazon, but they haven't brought any of those reviews to their website. There's nothing wrong with copying, literally control C on your keyboard, a review off Amazon and pasting it on your website. But a lot of people want to use plugins that automatically pull it in and like syndicates it. Just find like 10 of the best ones and copy and paste them and say it's from Amazon and then have a link so they can actually view that link on Amazon. Things like this. It seems like common sense, but no one does it.
I think that there are a lot of brands that want to put all of the things on one page and it makes it really long, right? But to your point, you know, saying what you are, I love your refresh. Example, because you're right. I have no idea what that is. It could be a shower, but it could also be a really cold beverage on a hot day. Mm-hmm. Like, what is it that you're selling to me? But I think that one of the things that I've seen across, you know, just kind of my career is everyone wanting to put everything like on the homepage and not sprinkling in all of the information and driving people to engage further. What are your thoughts on how much you put on each one of those pages, aside from, you know, the trust signals like reviews?
This is always a very fine line when we're working with different companies, is the designers are usually the problem, because the psychology of a designer is not a marketer or a salesman. Mm-hmm. So that's usually the issue, is you've got many different types of staff with different psychology all trying to come to an agreement. Like, when have you ever heard a developer and a creative agreeing on something? They both, the way that they view the world couldn't be more foreign. So that's usually where the issue comes into play. And then that's why I created this company. I have my head in both parts. So I was able to bring, and then the salesman side of it too. So then I was able to bring both those worlds, I guess, together. Usually it's the designers the hardest to work with. Imagine they've just created this beautiful website that they feel really proud and really happy with. And then our team comes in and then just chops it all up to make it convert better. Like, we have a lot of hard time and a lot of, you know, that the resistance is coming from the designer, because essentially we're breaking their art. So a lot of times, that's where the issue comes into play, because and that's where the mess comes from.
Well, it's personal.
Exactly. Which it shouldn't be at all. It's business, right?
Yeah, it's business. You have to think of the customer first. They're the person that ultimately is one that you want to either make the sale, sign up for the service, you know, sign up for an email, whatever it is, whatever purpose is behind your website is what you have to just kind of keep in mind. I used to work with someone that he would always say, I can create the ugliest website that is a better performing website than the prettiest website out there. So that's kind of that sentiment that always comes to mind when it comes to, you know, building or testing out, you know, a website that actually is one that creates conversions.
It's usually the first, it just happened today, actually. It's usually one of the longest discussion points on a sales call is them wondering if they should redesign their website first before they start split testing. Yeah. It's a strange thing that they, why would you go and completely overhaul what's working now and think you're going to get better results? So we did this with a client that was really persistent a few years ago. We split tested. They had like a standard WordPress. It may have even been a free theme, and their website was doing really well. They spent $20,000 on a redesign that was so slick. It looked so nice, but it was just overkill. So we split tested it, and it underperformed by 20%. Against the original, because the original was like a blog. It was like someone who's actually reviewed it. It had like the sidebar with the avatar of the guy and what he's all about, and he likes surfing and going on holidays with his family or whatever. Whereas this new one was like a really modern looking widgets everywhere, charts that were like animated and everything, and it got crushed. So it's always important to split test things, and a lot of times we have a hard time convincing the client that we don't want to do an overhaul. We just want to optimize and create more trust and fix how the website functions on mobile and stuff. So,
well, you know what I think that like the biggest difference in my opinion is that difference between the qualitative and the quantitative, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you're pushing the quantitative, like, let me test this out. Let me show you what actually performs versus the qualitative, right? The sentiment, that brand persona that you want people to, or that brand sentiment that you want people to just walk away with when they visit your website. It's just, it's constantly battling the both. I think that's also why I was really curious as to what that split is for you in, from a CRO perspective, what that split is between that qualitative and that quantitative, because that's kind of the way that I view that difference, because you will always be battling like brand sentiment. You have to, and as a brand, you do need to think about that. So it's not like you can only be quantitative, this performs, because essentially if you're trying to build a brand, there's got to be a balance in between the two. But to your point, you have to A/B test to see what's working for both.
And I think it's more the reason why we're like almost solely quantitative is because we work with more mature brands. So they've already done all that side of it, I guess, right? Yeah. So I'm a bit biased towards that view, but I'm 100% biased towards it because that's all we do, because we're working with companies that are trying to sell in 2 years or sell in 3 years or trying to maximize returns for their investors and things like this, rather than a bikini brand that's launching and they want it to appeal to their demographic before they really push for growth or investment or whatever. So it's just a different stage. Yeah, like you said, I think it's a great way to look at it, how you just said.
Well, excellent. That's why I get paid the big bucks. Just kidding.
There you go.
Okay, so I've taken up so much of your time. I have one final question. I always like to end with prediction time. I'd love to hear your thoughts on things that you see changing for brands or websites in the next 1 or 2 years when it comes to optimizing website performance.
Mm-hmm. I think it's what's interesting at the moment is the development of AI, right? Like it's AI that's writing AI now. So we're seeing like this huge growth in the speed of the evolution of AI. So I think what's going to happen is, and I think Shopify may be the first one to do it from an e-commerce perspective, is having like inbuilt optimization that's always running. Yeah. I don't know if you've heard of conversion.ai. It's like a AI that write copy. It's finally got good. I'm sure you were surprised the first time you dinged it in and you're like, wow, how did it just write that based off a few indicators? Because it's pulling all that data in from all these, you know, what are the top headlines of the best performing videos on YouTube and what are their descriptions? And then they meld it all up and then they're like, here you go. So I think that's going to play more of a part. I think the creative side, as much as most designers will probably hate what I'm saying right now, I think the creative side, especially when it comes to copy and the design of website, will be somewhat automated in the future. So I think like you'll go onto Shopify, you'll type what industry your website's in, what your products are, and most of the creation of the website is going to be automatically aggregated. And then I think it'll still be up to you sourcing the products, creating the products and so on. But I think the actual sales side of it, they know, because they have so much data on buyer psychology now, especially on Amazon and Facebook, and we can all be put into avatar groups. So it's like soon most of that's going to be taken care of. And I think that's just my opinion, because I can see it happening. I can see it happening slowly now as our business is changing.
I think
there'll be less like WordPress where you're like getting a custom design job done up from scratch and everything. I think it's going to be less and less, which I've seen it happen. Yeah. When I first started designing websites in 2003 or four, it was all hand coded and I could get paid like $1,000 or $2,000 for the most simple piece of crap website, five pages of like just crap. And now like you go onto Shopify, a few clicks, Wix, you can just drag and drop. Like WordPress has Divi and Elementor and all those themes that you can just drag and drop to build a website now. Like we're already heading there. It's already been like a huge evolution from when I first started. And so it's only going to continue at an exponential rate now, because technology is progressing so quickly. So will the evolution of all things on the internet. But we don't realize it's happening because it happens so gradually that it just becomes normal. Look at your phone, you know. Look at your phone now. It's more like my phone costs the same as my computer, and it's just as powerful. It's insane. So,
well, it's a computer in your pocket is really what it is. 100%. I don't know that I can. I'm ever away from my phone, or too far. If I am, I'm like, I need to be able to search things, look for things, hear things, track things, all the things. And I think that you hit the nail on the head. And you're not the only one to have like this prediction of AI. Every time I ask this question, it's starting to come up more and more often that AI is really going to just shuttle us into like the next one
it
to
is,
5 years.
I think it already is. But and the issue is whenever you bring it up, then you get the people on the cynical side, they're like, oh, this is scary, you know, AI. It's going to increase our life exponentially too. It's not going to have a negative aspect. Of course, people can always look for the negative side of things, but it's going to exponentially lift a lot of people out of poverty, a lot more people out of poverty that have already been lifted out of poverty in the last 10 years. Yeah. But, you know, with the cost of electronics getting cheaper, and the speed of the internet getting quicker, e-banking and everything, like the world's changing so quickly. Yeah. This will be just be another like look at Wise, TransferWise, like how they've changed the banking industry versus like, I haven't been into a bank in 5 years or 6 years. I couldn't even imagine it. But all these things, these are all things that are evolving at a very fast rate now, you know, and it's right in front of our eyes and we don't realize that that's how and why, you know, so.
Absolutely. Well, Kurt, thank you so much for letting me steal so much of your time, diving into just, you know, CRO, talking about AI, qualitative, quantitative, and all of those things in between. I really appreciated you joining us and just kind of sharing your wealth of knowledge.
Well, good. Anytime. Love. I could talk about it all day long. So all good.
Excellent. Thanks. During my chat today with Kurt, we talked about conversion rate optimization, where it started and where it's at now. We spent some time discussing when to focus on quantitative and qualitative metrics, as it's something that comes up quite often when you're first starting to build a brand. but something you focus on a little less so once you've established yourself. Ultimately, quantitative metrics can really help you make data-informed decisions to get you those sales. And the nugget that you will walk away with is trust. Your website ultimately has to provide trust, and that's in reviews, case studies, and your social feed, any badge or content that can provide insight as to how your service and or product will impact the end user is key to CRO. Want to hear more? Be sure to subscribe to the Grin Gets Real podcast to get the latest episodes and give us some stars. I wouldn't mind 5 of them, and leave us a review. It really does help. If you're interested in learning more about Grin, visit our website at grin.co. That's grin.co. Until next time, keep grinning.